efforts to make those connections between corporations and policing institutions continue, because what they do is they tell us lessons about capitalism and how capitalism does not serve our people well, and that the violence that we experience in tandem and in places of reproductive justice, in our homes, with police, even within the education system, those are connected to systems of capitalism, and that we have to dismantle those things. At the same time, if we're interested in creating a world that's actually safe for our children, where black women, black people, black trans folk, black queer folk can actually parent if we want to, parent, choose to not parent, and when we do choose to parent, we're able to do that and keep our children safe and have all the resources that we need.
I wanted
to reproductive justice.
I want to end with Michael Oppenheimer. You've represented a number of people in police brutality cases in Chicago. What are you calling for right now? How does Paul O'Neill fit into this story as we speak on the anniversary of the death of Michael Brown?
It would take hours, but we need, first of all, I'm asking for a special prosecutor to be appointed to look into this case immediately so there's no bias. They can look in and see what went on. I'm calling for answers to these questions, and we need to have programs where the police can interact with people in the community. So, like she said, we can have body cameras and depict this, but we need to have this stop. We need to have people in the community interacting with the police in a positive way. I'm calling for a special prosecutor in this case, and police need to be held accountable, just like any other profession, if they screw up.
We're going to leave it there. Michael Oppenheimer, the lawyer for the Paul O'Neill family, and Charlene Carruthers. Charlene Carruthers is National Director of the Black Youth Project 100. We will have a conversation about what happened in Pakistan and post it online at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkner, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Geisler, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th, 2016 at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. For the first time ever, Oregon's producers will be able to display live plants at the Cannabis Fair. Over 60 grows will be showcased this year, and there will be awards for the winning plants in several categories. Again, that's the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds, 2330 17th Street, Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resources table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th. At the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7, where the time is now 5:02 p.m. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House Internet services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today marks the second anniversary of the death of Michael Brown.
The president of the NAACP gets arrested.
And the nonprofit group Portland for Everyone stops in to talk to us live about how to re-legalize the city.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 9th, 2016. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. 4.5 minutes of national silence were called for today to mark the second anniversary of the death of Michael Brown at the hands of the police in Ferguson, Missouri. From 11:55 to 12 p.m. noon today, 4.5 minutes of silence were held in honor of Mike Brown. The 5-minute moment of silence was announced initially on Twitter. Brown was a teenager and unarmed at the time he was killed by the police in Missouri. His death at the hands of the police on August 9, 2014, helped launch the Black Lives Matter movement. This past Sunday, hundreds of people in Chicago marched by justice for Paul O'Neill, another Black teenager fatally shot by Chicago police on July 28.
In a video recently released by the Portland Art Museum, renowned Portland-based artist R.V. Smith talks about his painting that is currently being shown at the museum titled Hands Up, Don't Shoot, a work he created in reaction to the shooting of Michael Brown.
Shooting of a young African-American male in Ferguson, Missouri. And this young man was left lying in the streets for 4 hours. And this is what they used to do back in slavery. They would demonstrate what would happen to you if you defied the system. So this young man was lying there after being shot in the back by a policeman for 4 hours, and his family couldn't see him. It was totally insensitive and inhumane. And I had a visceral reaction to that. I think the media has a bird's eye view of what's going on, and they can report something or choose not to report it. And in this instance, they did report an unleashing of governmental violence unseen since the civil rights movement. And as Stokely Carmichael said, this is the demonstration of the consequences of being Black. My first experience with that is we were in the Black part of Jasper, Texas. It's not really in Jasper, it's the outskirts. I went into a restaurant. I was with my grandfather and my brother and I, and they said, "We don't serve colored here." And we were children. And I don't make the rules. Yes, you do. That was something that's obviously stuck with me all through my 70-odd years. It's a cliche, painting is worth 1,000 words. Well, I think it is, but I also think it will stimulate more than 1,000 words, because I think everybody comes at these strong emotional situations from their own frame of reference. And I'm going to see things one way, someone else is going to see it another way. Doesn't mean I'm right, doesn't mean they're right or wrong. We have a difference of opinion, and somewhere through dialogue, hopefully, we can come together and make this a better world to live in.
That was Portland-based artist R.V. Smith talking about his work at the Portland Art Museum entitled Hands Up, Don't Shoot. To see the video that the audio was taken from, go to Portland's Art Museum's YouTube channel.
A new nationwide survey shows that nearly two-thirds of Americans can't pass a financial literacy test, but some Oregon financial institutions are making financial education part of their outreach efforts. KBOO's Jumaane Ward-Lewis and the Oregon News Service has more.
Only 1 in 3 Americans is able to pass a financial literacy test, according to a new nationwide survey. Nearly two-thirds of participants said they struggle with such concepts as budgeting, credit, and long-term financial decision-making. Luke McMurray of Clackamas Federal Credit Union, which provides financial workshops for the community, says credit unions are trying to fill the gap. He says emotions are a big barrier for people when they start to think about their own finances.
So often we have so much baggage that comes from financial stress connected to budgeting, and those negative emotions really make it challenging.
The financial survey included more than 27,000 people across the country. According to the National Youth Involvement Board, credit unions nationwide have provided financial education for more than 500,000 students over the past year. McMurray says some people might shy away from managing their income just because it involves math skills. But he adds, if people give their finances, especially budgeting, the attention needed, it can actually improve their lives.
I think it is really important perspective that it is going to take a long time, and I think that helps people. And then, again, emphasizing, hey, this is a plan to create something that you really want that's going to achieve your goals.
Kevin Moran also works at Clackamas Federal Credit Union, providing financial education of the Spanish-speaking population. He says the parts of the Hispanic community he works with are largely unfamiliar with budgeting and rainy day funds.
They like hearing about it because it helps them become more proactive. And when it's coming to maybe an important graduation or something that maybe a car breaks down, they have those funds ready for them. And that way they don't have to get like a payday loan.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis.
Americans are working past retirement age. Although some have continued working to make up for losses from the Great Recession, others are working to make some extra cash and stave off the doldrums of retirement. KBOO's Layla Yao in the Oregon News Service has more.
Nearly one in five Americans in their golden years is still working. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the trend has been going steadily upward for decades. 20 years ago, about one in eight Americans older than 65 were working. The trend could be due in part to the Great Recession in 2008, which wiped out retirement savings and left many without jobs. But Adam Davis, founder of DHM Research in Portland, has surveyed the older population on their desire to keep working, and he says people's longer, healthier lives are also an important factor.
They like to work, and very important to that is that work returns some benefits, especially with respect to not only their physical health, keep them active, but their emotional and mental health as well.
Davis says that working longer also gives people extra cash, providing another source of income beyond Social Security benefits. Davis says there are other motivations to staying in the workforce besides health and added income. Salim Nurani is owner of the Cork and Bottle Shop in Corvallis and Springfield. He says the manager of his Corvallis store, who is 70, moved to Oregon after losing his job in the Great Recession and has added a lot to Nurani's business.
He had a difficult time finding a job, and when I first interviewed him, I immediately hired him on the spot because he had such great skill sets and work ethics that generally older people do, and that is just from an accumulation of working. You develop certain work ethics that you take through your whole life.
For KBOO News, this is Layla Yao.
The nonprofit group Portland for Everyone holds an event this week to talk about how to, quote, re-legalize the city. They're talking about the residential infill project, which might allow Portlanders to bring back housing construction options based on the standards of a half a century ago, rather than the current trend of McMansions dropped into neighborhoods. Here to talk about that is Portland for Everyone coordinator Madeline Kovacs. Thanks for coming in, Madeline.
Thank you for having me.
So what is Portland for Everyone? What is your mission?
So Portland for Everyone is a project of Thousand Friends of Oregon, which is a land use advocacy group here in Oregon that we're all really familiar with. Portland for Everyone is an initiative that is a coalition of affordable housing advocates, local businesses, neighbors, both owners and renters, and increasingly social justice groups who want to make sure that there are a number of land use planning and zoning trains going through the station right now. As a city, we haven't chance to impact the decisions that will be made around that land use that will also impact the housing supply and types of housing that will be available to Portlanders for a generation to come. So we want to make sure that Portlanders know the importance of these decisions. And also we want to make sure that we're advocating for abundant, diverse, and affordable housing in all of Portland neighborhoods. And that does mean everywhere. And that also means at all income levels.
So can you fill us in on what is the residential infill project? What is it and what does it aim to do?
Sure. So the residential infill project is one of these land use decisions that we're talking about. And what it is scoped to do is address three main things. Demolitions, the recent uptick in demolitions and replacement, largely with McMansions and single family zones, right? It's also meant to address narrow lots. So there are some areas of the city that are historically platted with narrower lots than are currently built on. It's also meant to address housing types. So how do we increase more flexibility for different smaller types of units arranged differently within single family zones, which make up 45% of our city's land area. And the project was actually born out of a desire to address a lot of concerns that had been brought by neighbors around demolitions and also around the production of McMansions, these huge houses, $700,000 that they're selling for. And so what the proposal on the books is doing right now is going to bring down the scale of houses to something like 2,500 maximum on a 5,000 square foot lot. And if the lot is smaller, the home size will be scaled accordingly, and also open up options for different housing types. So we're talking about accessory dwelling units. We're talking about little clusters of even smaller homes kind of arranged around a courtyard. We're also talking about duplexes, triplexes, things like that.
So I'm not incredibly versed about the current infill laws. What are the current infill laws that are preventing this? Or say your average homeowner, are they not allowed to divide their property?
No. So they wouldn't be allowed to per se divide their property under these new regulations either. But just to give an example, Buckman is a neighborhood that's highly touted as being a really interesting walkable place that has actually a lot of diverse housing types. And fun fact, even though it's zoned single family today, actually 80% of the housing available in a lot of parts of that neighborhood are non-conforming, meaning that if Buckman were to burn down today, the only thing that could be built to replace the majority of those homes that are zoned for single dwelling would be a single family house, which means you would actually lose an incredible amount of housing supply that's found in smaller apartment-like units nestled within these single family neighborhoods. A lot of parts actually of Inner Portland were built out under zoning codes that were in place in like World War I, World War II, which allowed multifamily development alongside single family development. And in 1959, that was essentially changed. And 45% of the city was essentially zoned single family. And a lot of that remains until today, which means that we don't have the ability to build out in places that are receiving new development. They don't have the ability to become denser and walkable and to have a range of unit types at different sizes and different price points. And it means the city is also not being as aggressive, we don't think, with the solutions that they're implementing to address Portland's housing crisis as they were in both periods of post-war years. We're not seeing the same sort of response and loosening of the code, and the residential infill project could be a really exciting exception to that.
So could you talk a little bit about what is middle housing?
Yeah. So middle housing, the term missing middle housing was coined by this guy named Dan Perolek. And it essentially refers to everything in between a single family home on one lot, and like a four-tier mixed-use apartment building. And we see both of those things going in all over Portland because that's what we're zoned to produce. So missing middle is everything in between. It's having ADUs, maybe both an interior ADU and an exterior ADU. It's cottage clusters, it's duplexes, it's triplexes, it's live-work type of situations. It's basically anything that allows you to be flexible in a residential, walkable, straddling that line of single-family, multifamily neighborhoods. And there are only four housing types that are being considered for single-family neighborhoods because they are smaller in scale, they are more discreet, they do fit into that fabric. The larger, like row homes, townhomes, things like that, we're talking about for multifamily zones.
So there's critics of the residential infill project, and they're calling it a land grab. Can you kind of address this pushback, and what are they trying to address in this pushback?
Sure. This is my opinion. I think there's actually a lot of confusion out there about what's causing what. I think people are looking around and they're seeing a huge degree of change really, really quickly. And people understandably, it's their home, it's their neighborhood. They like things the way that they are. And I think a lot for people who are comfortably in a home and who have owned a home for a long time, they don't see a reason why that should change. And so I think that there's a really, first of all, it's just a really understandable visceral reaction to change. I mean, but Portland is changing. And I think there's misunderstanding where demolitions come from. I think there's the perception that this project and that projects by the city have done something to trigger a lot of the demolitions and things that we've seen, when in fact what's really happening is the market has caught up and Portland is a desirable place to live. And we have, you know, these channels from Seattle and San Francisco and all over the country. It's like Portland has suddenly been discovered, right? And it's more affordable still than a lot of other places. So that influx of folks is not going to necessarily change all on its own. So the question is, what do we do about it? The question is, what are the rules of the game? And under the rules of the game, you're going to get McMansions. If you, all you can build is a single family house, if something does come down, that's what you're going to get. Or you're going to get things in mixed use zones where you can do more. And what we want to do is we want to open up the range of what's possible to address the wider spectrum of Portland's housing needs. So I think that the demolition question to me and where that's coming from and what we can do about it, I think is complicated. And I think there are some tools in the toolbox regulation-wise where we can address that. There are also other things that we can do that are outside of the residential infill project scope. Some things inside of it, some things outside of it, that can get at more of that question. And that is expanding access to internal conversions, right? Getting rid of the definition of household in our city's code, doing more adaptive reuse, incentivizing those things. Part of those incentives are within the residential infill project in terms of additional ADUs, providing accessible, affordable units, and letting current homeowners have access to that tool as well. And then others, we need to push the city to go even further.
We know we're almost running out of time here. But it really just sounds like you guys are really trying to present a longer-term solution for our housing crisis here. So I just want to make sure that we talk about your event that's happening tomorrow night. Can you give us some details about what's going to be happening?
Sure. Eli Spivak, who serves on our policy advisory committee and also actually serves on the Planning and Sustainability Commission with his other hat, he's very good about his two hats, will be presenting on largely this missing housing types. And he will be giving a proposal comparison about what the city is proposing and how Portland for Everyone is proposing something similar that isn't just around centers and corridors, that is also in all of our neighborhoods, and how those two things differ.
And where will this event be happening?
Yes, it's at Lucky Lab, Northwest Quimby, tomorrow evening. Doors open at 5:30, and we're going to be starting the presentation at 6.
And where can people find out more info if they want to get the details?
PortlandForEveryone.org.
Okay, well, we're all out of time, but thank you so much, Madeline, for coming in. That was Madeline Kovacs of the Portland for Everyone Project. You can find out more about their work at www.portlandforeveryone.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News in Depth at 5:45, followed by Preference at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy during the day with a high of 81 here in Portland, with clear skies at night. East of the Cascades and Hood River, tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 85, with winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Today in history, in 1936, track star Jesse Owens won his fourth gold medal at the Summer Olympic Games in Berlin. Owens had toyed with the idea of boycotting the games, but eventually decided to go in spite of the racial discrimination he knew he would face as an African-American athlete. He was famously snubbed by Hitler when the German leader refused to shake his hand. The quote of the day comes from Jesse Owens, who noted, quote, "Although I wasn't invited to shake hands with Hitler, I wasn't invited to the White House to shake hands with the president either," end quote.
It's 5:22. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Please, people, stop denigrating Donald Trump as a foreign policy ignoramus. After all, he's a global real estate tycoon with special insights into such U.S. adversaries as Vladimir Putin of Russia. I got to know Putin very well, the Donald has assured us voters. Only, it turns out that by very well, he meant not at all. For the Donald later conceded that he never actually, you know, met Putin. Still, he says he's taken the measure of the dictatorial Russian president from his corporate perch atop Trump Tower, concluding admiringly that Putin is, quote, a lot stronger than our leader, President Obama. Well, yes, if stronger means violently suppressing any opposition in his homeland, stealing billions of dollars from the Russian people for himself and his chosen oligarchs, invading Ukraine to seize the Crimean Peninsula, etc., etc. Picky, 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 says Donnie, who is so enamored of Putin that he publicly pleaded with a foreign strongman to hack into Hillary Clinton's computers in order to interfere with the USA's presidential election. Russia, Trump called out during a July press conference. If you're listening, I hope you're able to find Hillary's 30,000 emails that are missing. No need for Putin to invade and conquer the U.S. when the clueless Donald would willingly surrender our people's democratic sovereignty to him. Amazingly, while top Republican officials say they're horrified by Trump's twisted and traitorous invitation to Putin, they still say he should be president, shrugging off his dangerous shallowness as Donald being Donald. Imagine their scathing derision if Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton had invited Putin to intervene. This is Jim Hightower saying it's time for them to stop saying Trump is simply being entertaining. After all, bumbling bumpkin for president wouldn't even make a good TV show.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The president of the NAACP was arrested yesterday in Virginia during a sit-in to demand restoration of parts of the Voting Rights Act. NAACP President Cornell William Brooks was arrested alongside the organization's youth director, Stephen Green, at the office of Republican Congressman Bob Goodlatte. Green and Brooks were cited with criminal trespassing and released by the police. The NAACP cites a, quote, Machiavellian frenzy of voter suppression in states that deliberately make it harder for young people, college students, and minorities to vote, end quote, in the coming election. Federal appellate courts have recently blocked laws in North Carolina, North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Texas as violations of the Voting Rights Act.
The father of the teenager who built a homemade clock has filed a lawsuit against the school district that arrested his son. Ahmed Mohammed was arrested back in 2015 at his high school in Irving, Texas, after his homemade clock was mistaken for a hoax bomb. The 14-year-old was questioned by police for over an hour without his parents, then handcuffed and taken into custody. After being fingerprinted and had his mugshot taken, he was released to his parents and suspended from school for bringing a prohibited item. The lawsuit, which was filed yesterday, claims that the Irving Independent School District, the City of Irving, and MacArthur High School principal Daniel Cummings violated the teenager's civil rights. Mohammed, along with his family, moved to Qatar shortly after his story went viral in order to attend a school in Doha on a full scholarship. The teenager noted in a press conference yesterday that, quote, for the safety of my family, I have to go back to Qatar because right now it's not very safe for my family or for anyone who's a minority.
Activists are saying that Google has wiped Palestine off the world map. If one types Palestine into Google Earth at maps.google.com, it will show you that Palestine territories with the clear heading Israel. The International Middle East Media Center reports that 150,000 persons have already signed a petition to Google protesting the deletion. But other digital map makers say Google Maps has long had a mixed history in labeling Palestine versus Israel. On the larger map, the territory is labeled as Israel, but when you click on individual cities within that area, the name Palestine does appear. Different web platforms label the region differently. Bing's map system does name Palestine, but Apple Corporation's mapping products only identify Israel and do not include Palestine at all. Observers say the larger issue is the power of the Google Corporation to shape the world perception through the power of its mapping products. Washington Post writer Caitlin Dewey reports that some of Google's features identify Taiwan as an independent state, and that Crimea is referred to differently depending on whether you are searching from within Russia or the Ukraine.
A solar power plant is being built outside of a town in Uganda. In rural towns like Satori, Uganda, electricity is hard to come by. The plant is being funded by GetFit, a renewable energy facility run by the European Union. When finished, it will be the largest solar plant in sub-Saharan Africa. The plant will generate 10 megawatts of power and will supply electricity to 40,000 homes and businesses in the surrounding area. Uganda is heavily dependent on hydroelectric plants, which are vulnerable to droughts and dry spells. Since there's lots of sun in Uganda, solar plants will be a lot more reliable source of electricity. The plant is currently under construction and will be launched later this year.
The Olympic Games officially begin in Rio de Janeiro, and hundreds of thousands of tourists, athletes, and officials are expected to descend onto the city. Protesters held an anti-Olympics opening ceremony Thursday, decrying forced evictions and state violence in the run-up to the Games. FSRN's Sam Cowie reports.
As the Olympic Games begin, political uncertainty persists in the country. But for many residents of Rio de Janeiro, concerns are more basic, because they've been forced to move from the places they called home. Sonia Braga was told she had to abandon her home, which was then destroyed to make way for a rapid bus transit line, considered one of the main legacies of the Games. She was relocated more than an hour away from her former home, miles along a rutted road and far from the city infrastructure. The new place is an isolated area where organized crime is prevalent. Sonia, who suffers from high blood pressure, complains of long commutes now to visit her doctor, and worries that should an urgent medical situation arise, emergency vehicles might not reach her.
Here, if it's your turn to die, you will die. It's difficult for ambulances to get here. You have to go down to the main street to be picked up. By the time you've gone there, you'll die.
Between 2009, when Brazil won the right to host the Olympics, and 2015, according to official figures, more than 22,000 Rio families were forced to relocate and resettle elsewhere in the city. The number of evictions directly or indirectly linked to the Olympics remains contested, with City Hall claiming that just one favela, or shantytown, was removed to make way for the Olympic Park, Vila Autódromo, once home to some 900 families. But human rights groups say that many more families were uprooted for projects that were either directly or indirectly linked to the Olympics, that more like 2,500 families were forced out. Simone de Conceição lived in an abandoned factory in the centre of Rio, of around two dozen families with nowhere else to live. The building was razed as part of another so-called Olympic legacy project, the revitalisation of the port area that even includes a hotel developed by the controversial US presidential candidate, Donald Trump. De Conceição was relocated to a public housing block more than an hour from the city centre.
We have a good relationship with our neighbors, who we know from the city center. But apart from that, there are no good things here. The school is really bad and there is no work.
The housing situation, however, is not entirely black and white. Some families, arguably, have benefited from being placed in newly built public housing blocks. But human rights defenders and advocacy groups say this doesn't justify the top-down evictions that have primarily benefited Rio's real estate market. Orlando Santos Jr., a professor at the Urban and Regional Planning Research Institute at Rio State University, says that the first removals were brutal and that the conditions, including better compensation, only improved over time with resistance and media attention.
Even if people were living in better houses, does this justify the violence of the state to take people from their community? Does this justify a segregated model of urbanization where rich are separated from poor? Does it justify preventing people from deciding where to live?
The Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro will last just more than 2 weeks and will be followed by the Paralympic Games. For those removed from their homes, however, the legacy will be bitter and last a lifetime. Sam Cowie, FSRN, Rio de Janeiro.
Turkey may defy international pressure and reintroduce the death penalty in the wake of last month's abortive coup. That was a central theme of the weekend's massive Democracy and Martyrs rally in Istanbul. SFRN's Jacob Resnick has more.
Turkey hasn't executed anyone since 1984, and it officially abolished the death penalty 20 years later when it opened talks to join the European Union. But following the July 15th coup attempt, in which more than 240 people, mostly civilians, were killed, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan used a mass rally to declare that if it's the will of the people to restore capital punishment, he would make it happen. Turkey's parliament is controlled by the political party he co-founded, allowing Erdogan to use the bully pulpit to rubber-stamp legislation under the guise of popular support. And he made it clear to the million-plus strong crowd that diplomatic pressure from the European Union holds little sway over his plans.
There is no death penalty in Europe. It's not allowed by the European Council.
But it exists in America, in Japan, and in China. It exists today in many parts of the world.
Erdogan has used the coup to shore up political support and purge thousands of people suspected of plotting or being disloyal to the government. His government has suspended or dismissed tens of thousands of public sector workers, including police officers, judges, teachers, and soldiers. Many people, including accredited journalists, have had their passports canceled to prevent them from leaving the country. The Turkish military has reshuffled top officers. In all, about 18,000 people have been arrested or detained during the past 3 weeks. But the reintroduction of capital punishment would put Turkey on a collision course with its largest trading partner, the European Union. German government spokeswoman Ulrike Demmer repeated Monday that capital punishment is a red line issue that would scuttle EU membership talks.
It is clear that there is no place in the EU for a country where the death penalty exists. And a reintroduction of capital punishment in Turkey would mean the end of accession talks.
Turkey blames exiled U.S.-based Islamic cleric Fethullah Gulen for orchestrating the coup and demands that Washington extradite the religious leader to stand trial. The U.S. says it's waiting for hard evidence before it considers Turkey's extradition request. Sunday's rally also included opposition leaders but excluded the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, which has criticized Turkey's violent crackdown on rebellious Kurds in the southeast. Jacob Resnick, FSRN.
Now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Beloved historian Howard Zinn once said, quote, "Civil disobedience is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is that people are obedient while the jails are full of petty thieves, and all the while the grand thieves are running and robbing the country," unquote. We all know he was right. One of the more tragic current examples of how American social movements continue to fall into this trap of civil obedience is how our anti-GMO organizations have responded to Monsanto Corporation's proposed DARK Act, which bans states from requiring the labeling of GMO foods, and which our Congress, Senate, and President Obama all passed into law over these last few weeks, even though it was opposed by 90% of Americans. Because the DARK Act is now law, Vermont's existing law that requires all foods containing GMOs to be labeled has been struck down and can no longer be enforced. For years now, the Organic Consumers Association, Center for Food Safety, Food Democracy Now!, and other national and state organizations have been leading the American people down a path of civil obedience, consistently claiming that if they can just get more signatures on their online petitions, if they can just get another wave of donations from their millions of supporters, that they will continue to win against Monsanto Corporation and its allies. If that were actually true, the DARK Act would not have been passed by an overwhelming majority of both Democrats and Republicans. Obama would have vetoed it, and numerous states would have already successfully banned, not labeled, GMO foods. So clearly something is terribly wrong with the strategy that these anti-GMO groups are asking us to follow. Is there a better alternative? Of course there is. For some perspective regarding what we the people should do when our federal government overrules our inherent right to protect our health and welfare, let's go way back to 1996, 20 years ago, when California voters passed Proposition 215, legalizing medical marijuana for the first time in our modern history. The law they passed was illegal. It violated federal law. Did you know that? And once it was passed, California's legislature, its governor, its attorney general, its sheriffs, were all required to enforce that new state law, which created what is called a crisis of jurisdiction. In the years that followed, voters in one state after another passed similar laws, all of them illegal under federal law, but they did it anyway. Fast forward to today, and we can see that the voters in dozens of states have successfully overruled the federal government and preempted federal authority through the ballot box. Imagine if medical marijuana activists had instead spent those 20 years sending online petitions to our federal government, begging them to legalize medical marijuana. It would still be illegal. Thank goodness they chose civil disobedience over civil obedience in 1996 by exercising their authority at the ballot box. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass once said, quote, Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will, unquote. Regarding GMOs in our food, where's our demand? Online petitions? Public education campaigns? Ineffective consumer boycotts? Come on now. The community rights movement has taught us that if we want to build real political power, we don't beg and plead with our so-called leaders. We exercise our inherent authority to govern ourselves. So what's stopping Vermont's government from following a similar path? Imagine if Vermont's governor, state legislature, attorney general, and sheriffs were letting the feds know that they would be ignoring the new federal preemption law and moving forward with implementing the state labeling law that they had already passed. Imagine if the citizens of Vermont were in the streets, actively supporting their elected officials. What's the worst thing that could happen? Would the feds dare to arrest Vermont's legislators and governor? And if they did try to arrest them, imagine the democratic uprising that would ensue across the country. The feds couldn't possibly win in this battle in the court of public opinion. Which begs the question, why isn't this already happening? Why are we all so civilly obedient to laws which violate our rights? Which brings me back to the Organic Consumers Association, Center for Food Safety, and Food Democracy Now!, which are all treating the new federal law as an outrage, but as legitimate, rather than as a fundamental violation of our inherent right of self-government. Yes, they plan to sue the federal government to challenge the DARK Act, but this will take years and a ton of money, while the public once again gets demobilized and confused about where ultimate power resides. Last week, Ronnie Cummins, executive director of Organic Consumers Association, wrote an essay about this issue titled, "Corporate Money Defeats GMO Labeling. What Would Gandhi Do?" Given that title, I was hoping he was finally ready to contemplate a new, bolder strategy, one that would have made Gandhi proud. But sadly, I was wrong. Cummins is still stuck in what has come to be known as the colonized mind. He continues to be convinced that our real power is as consumers. He's dead wrong. Consumer power is a diversion. In fact, consumer power is a concept that was invented by the public relations industry as a way to confuse Americans as to where their real power resides, which is as we the people, as citizens, exercising our self-governing authority. If you care deeply about states having the right to pass laws to protect the health and welfare of their citizens, I urge you to contact Vermont's governor, state legislators, and attorney general, and urge them to enforce their existing GMO labeling law, regardless of what our federal government says. Remind them that dozens of states have successfully legalized medical marijuana, even though federal law preempts them from doing so. And while you're at it, how about also contacting the Organic Consumers Association, Center for Food Safety, and Food Democracy Now!, and urging them to shift gears towards a more civilly disobedient set of tactics and strategies, taking their lead from the community rights movement. We the people have an inherent right of self-government. Let's make Gandhi proud. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can access contact information for all of the groups I've mentioned here by going to the text version of this commentary at paulcienfuegos.com. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Layla Yao, Jamani Ward-Lewis, and Tony Longshanks. The producer is Jenny Yokoyama. Special thanks to the Oregon News Service and Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seiwe. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Paul Roland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Per Fagerang speaks with former Portland professor Zahir Wahab, who now lives and works in Afghanistan as a professor of education at the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Gene Bradley interviews Bob Hatton, program director of Portland Fruit Tree Project, and Weston Miller, OSU Extension Service horticulturalist. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking donate. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, Kanan. Good night, Wesley.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
In addition to a slate of candidates, Oregonians will be asked to vote on 5 ballot measures this November. And while many feel that this year's presidential race is the most important in decades, Oregon Measure 97, also known as IP-28, has a potential for significant impact in the state. If passed, the Oregon Business Tax Increase Initiative would require C corporations, which are typically the largest publicly held companies, to pay a 2.5% tax on all sales in excess of $25 million per year within the state of Oregon. It would apply to both in-state and out-of-state corporations, and is projected to raise about $3 billion per year. It would be the biggest tax increase in Oregon history. It would increase the total state tax revenues by about 25%. The ballot initiative specifies that new revenues generated by the tax would be targeted towards education, health, and senior citizen services. The Oregon Center for Public Policy, an organization devoted to the advancement of policies and practices that improve the economic and social opportunities of all Oregonians, has come down strongly in favor of Measure 97. Communications Director Juan Carlos Ordonez put it this way.
IP-28, or what will be Measure 97, is really our first opportunity to change things for the better, to bring in the kind of revenue that we need to provide all our kids a quality education and to address some of those needs and aspirations that Oregonians have. We see it as a real game changer in terms of Oregon tax policy and in terms of our ability as a state to fund those